Ravel's Piano Concerto in G major, a piece the composer himself called his most Ravelian work. Certainly it's got all the musical DNA of the man, full of rambunctious energy, strange kind of longing, that balance of freedom and control that Ravel loved in his music. Obviously, of course, the debt to jazz composers as well, like Gershwin. Ravel himself had intended to play the first performance of the piece, but he found that in spite of intense and exhaustive exercises studying people like Chopin, he couldn't actually play the piece, just too difficult. A feat more than achieved here at the Proms by tonight's soloist, Hélène Plimaud. The Sydney Symphony Orchestra here with their principal conductor, Vladimir Ashkenazy. And they were led in that performance by the concertmaster, Dean Olding. Well, as Hélène Grimaud said earlier on, she's adored the music of Ravel since childhood. One of the composers she grew up with, she told me earlier she learned the left-hand concerto as a kid. She says it's time to record it when I get a gap in my schedule, hopefully in a couple of years' time. So something very much to look forward to from her. She's touring worldwide at the moment, but she'll be back in London the first week in September. She'll be playing Brahms' first piano concerto with Esa-Pekka Salonen and the Philharmonia. Well, the audience here are clapping and stomping. They want Hélène Grimaud back on stage. And here she is. Much tapping of bows and applause from the members of the orchestra here. And she, in return, gives them a very charming thumbs up. So, time now for the interval. Still to come this evening, Scriabin's Third Symphony, The Divine Poem, as ecstatic, heady, and mystical a piece as you will ever hear. Well, earlier today, Susan Hitch was joined by the composer James McMillan and the religious poet Michael Simmons-Roberts to explore the relationship between poetry and the divine. The event was part of the Proms Literary Festival just across the road.
Hello and welcome to the Royal College of Music and tonight's event in this year's Proms Literary Festival. This year's Proms have been exploring the music of Alexander Scriabin, and this evening we'll be hearing his third symphony, subtitled The Divine Poem, which he saw as expressing a cosmic dance between the human spirit and the universe. Poetry has expressed the human relationship to the divine, God or spirit, or just a sense of something other, since the beginnings of human creativity, from the Hebrew poetry of the Bible to the Buddhist sutras, from Rumi to Ratushinskaya, Dante to Donne. So this evening, we'll be talking about the relationship between poetry and the divine in some poems particularly chosen by my guests. The composer James McMillan, very familiar to us here at the Proms, whose work is deeply engaged with the liturgical and spiritual, and the prize-winning poet Michael Simmons-Roberts, who's been described as a religious poet for a secular age. You can hear a suite from one of their many collaborations, The Sacrifice, in our Prom on September the 6th. And our poems this evening will be read by the actor Khalid Abdallah, fresh from The Kite Runner and Green Zone. Please welcome them now. Michael, do you think there's a natural connection between poetry and the divine?
I do. If poetry is closer to music than to prose, which I think it is, and if poetry is our most heightened use of metaphor, which I think it is, then both those, I think, make it ideally suited to explore and evoke the divine. The quest, I think, takes place through language, the exploration of why we're here and what we're doing here and what the sacred might mean, is fundamentally a linguistic quest, I believe. So, yeah.
James, you as a composer, you obviously set language, you set texts, but is it for you the way best to access the divine in a secular world?
It's one of the ways, but musicians are proud of the fact that music is an abstract form, that it speaks to the human brain and heart without any, fundamentally without any other reason for existing, without any other collaboration with the other arts. Of course, it can collaborate very well with the other arts, but at a fundamental level, music has this strange and mysterious power to communicate meaning, perhaps, certainly feeling, to human beings without being specific with word or image like the other arts.
we're talking at the beginning of the 21st century. This is not obvious to everybody in this culture and this time. Why are we sitting here talking about poetry and the divine?
Poetry is in an odd position in our culture. In one sense, it's very marginalised. People who would be embarrassed not to have read the latest novel by a key British novelist would not necessarily have read Seamus Heaney's latest collection. So there's a sense in which it doesn't have a broad audience. It's not common currency anymore. On the other hand, it does seem still to have almost, you could say, a sacred role within the culture. People don't tend to read extracts from novels at funerals. It's poetry they reach for at times like that. The same with love, and the same with the quest for the sacred. So I think it is still crucial and central while simultaneously being slightly marginalised, if I can hold those things together.
Well, let's hear our first reading. It's from Emily Dickinson, who, of course, wasn't read at all until after her death. It's Emily Dickinson feeling the brute power of divinity. He fumbles at your soul. Khalid.
He fumbles at your soul. As players at the keys, before they drop full music on, he stuns you by degrees, prepares your brittle nature for the ethereal blow, by fainter hammers further heard, then nearer, then so slow. Your breath has time to straighten, your brain to bubble cool, deals one imperial thunderbolt that scalps your naked soul. When winds take forests in their paws, the universe is still.
Thanks, Khalid. Michael, that poem of Emily Dickinson, it's full of a kind of physical, violent sense of God. It's very sensory, it's very physical, it isn't subtle at all. Her soul is scalped. What's going on there?
I love that about her work, and it's akin to what John Donne does in his poems. Famously, when he was a sacred poet, he was also a love poet, an erotic poet, and vice versa. And I think this Emily Dickinson poem is so full of it's ecstasy, but it's also fear. It's a sort of terrifying ecstasy, but it's definitely physical, and it gives the lie to the idea that sacred poetry is something airy fairy, something remote from the body. I think it's an extraordinary rush of power and intensity in that poem.
It's also startlingly personal, isn't it, James?
This is the kind of spiritual art that I prefer. And by that I mean I prefer it to those forms of art, whether in music or poetry, that ethereally cuts off the spiritual from the physical. This is, as you said, a sensual, physical, religious poem. Its encounter with the sacred is entirely in the here and now, in the sense it's entirely here and now in her body, in our bodies. And that's the kind of incarnate spiritual encounter that means a lot to me because of the background I'm from. And it's probably why I'm drawn to this kind of poetry. It's entirely rooted in our physical humanity, and it's a kind of spiritual questing in arts and culture that I much prefer to esoteric, occultish New Ageism of the main work we're going to hear in the prom later tonight by Scriabin, where the spirit is quite clearly separated, deliberately separated from our physical selves.
But even when you're talking about something, a poetry as physical as Emily Dickinson, there's a sense in which, you know, both music and poetry can be really difficult, often are accused of being really difficult. How is it then that we want to argue that they're the high road to a sense of the divine? Because that's for everybody.
Well, life is difficult, and our encounters with the deeper thoughts can be very difficult. And I find poetry difficult in the same way as perhaps some people find classical music or contemporary music difficult. But it is worth pursuing The engagement is worth pursuing because you know that there is a fundamental, deeper joy in the engagement that is achieved after that depth has been undergone. I think that's why when I set poetry, for example, Michael's poetry and other things, I live with the poem for a long time, a necessary long time, so that I fully understand it and that the music can wrap itself round the words in a way that brings out the deeper meaning that is not immediately apparent in first encounter.
I think difficult is a difficult word. And it brings to mind something that the poet Geoffrey Hill said, which is when he was confronted with the idea that his poetry was difficult, he said, my poetry is difficult because we are difficult. And I think that's right. Why should any art aspire to be less complex and rich and interesting than we are?
Well, let's have another reading now. It's from The Dream of Gerontius, which is John Henry Newman's, Cardinal Newman's, poem about a dying man. And it's best known, of course, from Elgar's great setting. James, you chose this passage. Can you introduce it for us?
Yes. As a very young composer, still in my teens, I encountered this poem through Elgar's great oratorio, The Dream of Gerontius, and encountered someone I didn't know anything about. And indeed, although we're going to be hearing a lot about him in the next few weeks, a lot of British people don't know enough about John Henry Newman. He was a poet, and in his writings as a theologian, and perhaps with his beatification next month when Pope Benedict's here, we'll also get a chance to reappraise him as a literary figure. This is a vision of death, a vision of a man at the end of his life, about to proceed purgatorially to the next stage.
I went to sleep, and now refreshed. A strange refreshment, for I feel in me an inexpressive lightness and a sense of freedom, as I were at length myself, and ne'er had been before. How still it is. I hear no more the busy beat of time, no, nor my fluttering breath, nor struggling pulse, nor does one moment differ from the next. I had a dream, yes. Someone softly said, "He's gone." And then a sigh went round the room. And then I surely heard a priestly voice cry, "Sub venite," and they knelt in prayer. I seemed to hear him still, but thin and low, and fainter and more faint the accents come, as at an ever-widening interval. Ah, whence is this? What is this severance? This silence pours a solitariness into the very essence of my soul. And the deep rest, so soothing and so sweet, hath something too of sternness and of pain.
James, you've already explained that this piece of poetry that you first heard in Elgar's setting was particularly important to you. Did it set you off down a particular route as a composer?
It kind of pointed to me that there was a way of being a composer, and indeed a composer that was able to draw deeply from this very, very same reservoir of culture that we're talking about, the Judeo-Christian experience. Messiaen was another of these composers who pointed the way and said, yes, you can do it too.
Now, Newman is very insistent on that combination of sweetness and sternness and pain. Do you think that combination is part of what poetry does in conveying the divine?
The thing that I find most arresting about it is the idea of this person carrying on, as it were, after death, and almost as an afterthought, realizing that these physical functions have stopped functioning, that the fluttering breath and the struggling pulse are no longer there. I find that an extraordinary, sort of quite almost scandalous idea, but very effective, very vivid.
He's talking about the sensation of having left this world, but is still using words which evoke our physical nature, and indeed talks of pain, which is a very, very physical sensation, and rest, which is soothing and sweet. I find these things very, very consoling, and I recognize in this view of something beyond ourselves, something of ourselves which is more than the sum of our parts, if we like, just which is, I think, what we all thirst for in our culture and in our attempts to understand who we are, that poets like Newman, but not just religious poets, will use these images and metaphors to point to our common humanity.
And actually, it's probably a tradition of all religions and all cultures. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, everything from the Hebrew poetry of the Bible to Buddhist sutras. I mean, it seems to be a common language. Our next poem was written by a Jewish poet, Paul Celan, in the years after the Second World War. And actually, this is the one that opens for us one of the great themes of religious poetry, which is the absence of God. Paul Celan's psalm in a translation by Michael Hamburger, Khalid.
No one moulds us again out of earth and clay. No one conjures our dust. No one. Praised be your name, no one. For your sake, we shall flower towards you. And nothing we were, are, shall remain, flowering the nothing, the no one's rose. With our pistol soul bright, with our stamen heaven ravaged, with the crimson word which we sang over, oh, over the thorn.
Michael, you chose this poem for us. Why is it important to you?
And for a number of reasons. Some of them are very personal reasons. I was a cradle atheist. And when I was in my university undergraduate days and began to lose my atheism, I was worried about the effect it would have on my poetry because I'd always been writing poetry. And I thought, incredibly naively, that if I did cross the line and become a believer, my poetry would somehow lose its edge or would become monochrome or devotional in a sort of pious way. I obviously hadn't read enough Paul Celan, or there are plenty of examples. I was, as I say, very naive about it. This is, I believe, a sacred poem, and it's a sacred poem because it addresses absence, but it addresses absence in a liturgical form. So it's a psalm-like address to God as no one, as absence.
So it's a very present absence.
It's a very present absence, but it goes deep into Judeo-Christian history, where there's a mystic tradition of the crux of meaning being on the borders of presence and absence, where that possibility lies. Is there a God or is there not a God? And then you've got someone else, a great hero of mine, like Simone Weil, the French writer who believed that atheism could be closer to true faith than a lot of believers are, because atheism at least rejects false images of God, the images that we've created that are just masking what and who God is.
But this is a sense of God in absence which comes out of appalling pain. I mean, Celan lived through the camps, lived through the labour camps of the Second World War. His parents died in them. What do you say to an atheist who hears, no one moulds us again out of earth and clay, no one conjures our dust, no one, and who just says, well, no one. How do you, can you make comfort out of this? Can you make belief out of this? Or do you just say the poem is not for them?
It's not a poem of comfort, I don't think. I don't think you can take comfort from it. Celan, as you say, had seen both his parents die in concentration camps. Bear in mind also, this is someone who was writing in German because it was the language of his poetry. It was his first language, but it was also the language of the oppressors who had killed his parents. So this is, it's full of pain, as you say, and anguish.
James, The question of comfort, is that something that you can, that poetry can offer, that music can offer?
For a musician, for a composer, that absence is indeed silence, the silence from which music emerges in the first place, the silence, that emptiness, the pre-compositional nothingness out of which music has to grow. So in the act of composition itself, in the preparing of the mind, one is aware of a sense of absence, but that absence is absolutely pregnant with possibility, because one knows, one hopes, that in that silence music will bud and grow.
And is that what you mean when you say that any form of creativity is a sacred act?
Probably.
You're off out to dinner afterwards, I know, to do the next bit of work together, aren't you? What does that piece of work look like to those of us who are neither poets nor composers when you two say you're going out for the evening to do some work? What is it? What do you actually do?
What do you think?
Well, you clearly have a good dinner, but what else?
Well, yes, I mean, although we talk today and on many occasions, Michael and I, about the sacred in art, I think that what we actually do is a very secular thing. I set a lot of liturgical texts for specific use in worship. But when Michael writes poetry for me, I always regard them as strangely secular pieces for a secular world, or for a theologically neutral world at least, but they are tinged with something that is deep in our backgrounds, our psychologies and so on. I feel very privileged to be involved with the genesis of Michael's libretti at the very beginning. It's not often that a composer can sit down with a poet before even a word is written and be involved in that initial discussion. So it makes it very, very exciting.
That's, I'm afraid, where we have to leave it. Thank you very much to my guests, James McMillan and Michael Simmons-Roberts, to our reader, Khalid Abdallah, and to all of you in our audience here at the Royal College of Music.
Susan Hitch was talking to the composer James McMillan, the poet Michael Simmons-Roberts, the reader Khalid Abdallah, and the programme was produced by Allegra McIlroy. And a warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for this prom from the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and their music director, Vladimir Ashkenazy. Just one piece left on the programme tonight. It's Scriabin's Third Symphony, music full of rapture, evanescence, a portrait of the mystical relationship between man and the universe. Before the music, time to talk to my guest this evening. She's Margaret Throsby. She's here from ABC, all the way from Australia. Margaret, we were talking earlier about the fact that this orchestra was founded in 1932. It's made its home in the Sydney Opera House. That building is famous for its bad acoustic. A great building, but a terrible acoustic. How do they find it there?
Well, I think, like everybody else, that the acoustic is famously not very good. Many people think that the ideal concert hall would be the concert hall in the Melbourne Arts Centre with the exterior of the Sydney Opera House, because the Melbourne one has a famously good acoustic. However, they're going to be working on the Sydney one and bringing it up to scratch in the not-too-distant future.
Well, you mentioned Melbourne. From what I understand, there is this kind of famous rivalry between the symphony orchestras of Sydney and Melbourne as to who's better.
Between everybody in Sydney and everybody in Melbourne, they say.
But you have no take on that, of course, because you are utterly impartial as part of the
Australian
Broadcasting Corporation.
Well, I'm utterly impartial because half my family came from Melbourne, yes, indeed.
And just to give us a broader sense of the kind of cultural scene in Australia at the moment, it seems from the outside certainly to be incredibly vibrant, that you've got lots of generations of fantastic composing going on. You've got people like Peter Sculthorpe, then younger composers like Brett Dean. It seems like Australia is just buzzing at the moment.
The music scene is very, very vital in Australia, which is great. I mean, it really is wonderful in the Sydney Symphony. What's this?
Now, this is Margaret's first time at the prom, so I shall explain to her. These are the promenaders. And every single night they tell us how much they've collected for musical charities, and they get a large round of applause. It's one of the many traditions of the proms.
Fantastic.
Margaret is sitting next to me looking utterly delighted.
It's wonderful. So you don't get this in Aussie concerts then?
No, you certainly don't. We're all very well behaved.
Of course, goes without saying. Now, The Proms is live every night here on BBC Radio. Does the festival make any kind of an impact in Australia?
The Proms? Oh, certainly. We broadcast them on ABC Classic FM, my network. In fact, this is going to air at a Saturday lunchtime. And we broadcast the whole series, yes, indeed.
Fantastic. Well, Margaret, great to talk to you and fantastic to have you here with me at the Proms.
Thanks for having me, Susie.
Pleasure. Well, as we just said, a few moments now before the last piece on tonight's programme, Scriabin's Divine Poem. It was written between 1902 and 1904, so very firmly in that fin de siècle period when all sorts of stuff about mysticism, the divine, the occult was floating around. Even so, Scriabin's own massive cult of personality was extreme for those times. He once famously said, "I am God." Scriabin was never one for personal modesty. He charmed fashionable Moscow circles in the 1890s with his impeccable dress, his brilliant conversation. Then in 1904, at the age of 32, he left Russia to go to Switzerland with his mistress. She was his greatest supporter. She believed utterly in his delirious messianic visions of delivering the whole world to redemption through his own music. Scriabin spent much of his later years obsessed with writing a week-long piece of music called Mysterium, a show involving music, dance, light, perfume, set in a temple at the foot of the Himalayas. He never completed it, so we shall never know what that work sounded like. But now we shall hear his divine poem, Vladimir Ashkenazy, back on stage.
Thank you.
I am desire, I am light, I am nothing, I am God. The words of Scriabin, his symphony number 3, the divine poem, performed here at the 2010 BBC Proms by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and conductor Vladimir Ashkenazi. An utterly authentic Russian fire and passion from the baton of Ashkenazi. He's 73 years old. He sprints onto the podium, I have to tell you, like a teenager. Incredible physical energy in his performance and a great sense of energy and communication between him and the players. The Sydney Symphony Orchestra led in that piece by Michael Dowd. He's the co-concert master with Dean Olding, who we heard leading in Ravel. This orchestra returning to the Proms after a 15-year absence. And Ashkenazi bringing to their feet some of the principals, section principals, trumpets, Daniel Mendlow, the principal horns, Ben Jacks, Hector MacDonald, all the brass section now on their feet. And applause for the leader, Michael Dowd. Well, Ashkenazi first came to the Proms in 1967 as a pianist. Then he played Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Colin Davis conducting. He's been back, of course, many times since as a pianist and conductor. He's a great fan of this festival. The Proms, he says, really raises the spiritual level of this nation. English music with a French title, played by an Aussie orchestra, conducted by a Russian. Proof, if it were needed, of the Prom's credentials as a truly international music festival. Elgar's Chanson de Matin was performed by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and conductor Vladimir Ashkenazi. The encore to their concert here this evening. Well, as we said earlier, they are on a frantic European tour, 8 cities in 2 weeks. They've got a couple of dates coming up at Usher Hall, part of the Edinburgh International Festival, the 1st and 2nd of September. And Ashkenazi, the entire orchestra on their feet now. And that is it for this evening here at the Proms. I will be back on Radio 3 on Sunday morning at 10. I do hope you can join me then. Meanwhile, here at the Proms tomorrow night, Norwegian Chamber Orchestra here with Mozart's sparkling Hafner Symphony, his C minor piano concerto. Leif Ove Andsnes, the soloist there. Also on the bill, music by Grieg and a new piano concerto from Bent Sorensen. 7:30 live as ever here on Radio 3. But for now, time to hand you back to Ian Skelly.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. Now, if you tuned in halfway through that prom or even just during the encore, then a week today you can hear it all again here on Radio 3 during the Proms Repeat. That's at 2 in the afternoon. Or, of course, you can visit the Radio 3 website and listen to it anytime you'd like to for the next 7 days using the BBC iPlayer, bbc.co.uk/radio3. And the website is the place to go if you'd like to share your views on tonight's performances. Plenty of lively reviews and opinions to read if you go to bbc.co.uk/proms and then click on the button marked share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, stay with us here on Radio 3 tonight as Samuel Johnson joins the 21st century. What would the great wordsmith have made of our use of the word today? Well, in the second essay of the week, Freya Johnston, that is, no relation, considers how Johnson's hatred of fashionable and trendy turns of phrase that don't mean anything has influenced today's use of the English language. Telling it like it is tonight's essay. You can hear it at 11. Our next programme, though, tonight offers the chance to hear the views of one of the most perceptive commentators on dance, Judith Mackerel. She presents a very illuminating survey of the history and legacy of the Ballet Russe that dazzled audiences both in London and Paris. Not, though, just because of the composers and the dancers Diaghilev employed. Let's not forget the contributions that came from the many artists, Picasso, Matisse, Benoit among them, whose designs have continued to influence fashion ever since. Les Ballets Russes is at 10 tonight here on BBC Radio 3. But with the time at, 13 minutes to 10, we have a little chance for some more music. And first the music of Chopin. This is one of his late compositions, the Barcarolle in F-sharp minor, composed in 1846. It's played here by Stephen Hough.
Thank you.
exquisitely lyrical, Chopin's Barcarolle, Opus 60, played on that recording by Stephen Huff. Well, we leap forward 20 or so years now to the late 1860s and to a form of music that Brahms had been fascinated by all his life. And his close friendship with the violinist Josef Joachim gave him the opportunity to explore his love of Hungarian folk music and its many enchanting, seductive themes. One of Brahms's many Hungarian dances, that was the fourth of those from books one and two that Joachim, the violinist, transcribed for Violin and Piano, published in 1871, played there by the violinist Aaron Rosend and the pianist Hugh Sung. And it brings the time to just after 10 o'clock. A very good evening to you. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and also online. Well, next tonight, the dance critic, Judith Mackerel, tells the story of the infamous dance company, the Ballet Russe.
I'm here at Covent Garden because the Royal Ballet are joining in the world celebrations of the Diaghilev centenary. In Paris in 1909, the audiences were pretty much used to ballet as being a very moribund art form, cliched, formulaic, all about the ballerina's pretty legs, not about art. And Diaghilev brought this troupe of young Russian dancers and artists and set in motion this complete revolution that transformed the art of ballet. Among the works I'm seeing tonight is The Firebird, which was premiered in 1910 and which is absolutely critical in the Ballet Russe repertory and in the world's repertory now. It's a work that took the fairy tale ballet straight into the 20th century with this electric, experimental choreography with its clashing colours and serrated rhythms. It was a work where music, design, and choreography all came together to create a modernist work of art.
Spectacular. Loved every moment of it. Colourful, tuneful, beautifully danced, especially the Firebird.
I loved it because I really like Stravinsky. It's dramatic, it's spiky, it's really there, and it goes well with dance.
Beautiful movement, everything one can wish for from a Firebird. She was lovely, really good.
Certainly the rest of the audience tonight seem as beguiled by it, if not perhaps as shocked as the Parisian audiences were at its premiere. It still holds the stage. Inevitably, there are parts of it that seem, if not dated, then particularly of their period. But you still get this sense of this extraordinary historic moment where Russian traditions are on a collision course with the art and design and music of the 20th century.
I think it would be pretty hard to imagine what the world of dance would be like if the Ballet Russe hadn't existed. I think it's almost an essential part of dance history. It was a period of stagnation before, and I think Diaghilev just came in and created a whole new way of working. And I think we are still seeing that legacy right now.
I think the fact that ballet is considered an art of importance is Diaghilev's doing. The fact that you can have music by real composers is Diaghilev's doing. The fact that you can have artists of major proportions is again Diaghilev's doing.
I've been fascinated by Diaghilev since I was a teenager, and partly it's just the glamour of the company that he assembled. The dancers he worked with were amazing. Anna Pavlova, Vaslav Nijinsky, Tamara Kasavna. All of these were emerging stars from the Mariinsky, the Imperial Theatre in St. Petersburg. Even more impressive were the collaborators that Diaghilev worked with, some of whom were so cutting edge that they now read like a who's who of modernism. Composers like Stravinsky and Satie and Prokofiev, painters like Picasso and Matisse. His choreographers were Fokine, Balanchine, Massine, Nijinsky. What intrigues me, though, is what instinct did Diaghilev possess, not just to identify that talent, but to somehow put it all together into one company? And what did it cost Diaghilev to keep it all going for 20 years, not only surviving war and revolution, but holding together this group of artistic egos, some of whom were as difficult and rackety as any modern rock band? Writer and Ballet Russe historian Lynn Garofola.
Diaghilev came to St. Petersburg to find a future. He worked briefly inside the Imperial Theatres. He organized extraordinary exhibitions. And he really looked forward to a reorganization of the arts in 1905 as a result of the revolution. But there was no reform coming, and he felt. I think there was no place for him inside Russia, but that abroad he'd have much greater opportunity to make his own way.
I'm in the departure lounge for Eurostar, waiting for the train that's going to take me to Paris 100 years after Diaghilev, and hoping to discover something of the city that he encountered with his new dancers. Although the company were called the Ballet Russe, they weren't actually based in Russia full-time. It was very much a Russian export that Diaghilev wanted to impress Europe with. For him, Paris was the capital of European culture, and Parisian audiences were the most discerning, the most sophisticated, and the people he most wanted to impress.
Mesdames, Messieurs, bienvenue à bord de cette Eurostar à destination de Paris. Veuillez placer vos bagages.
Diaghilev had it in his bones to be an innovator.
Choreographer Millicent Hodson, who's dedicated much of her career to reconstructing some of the lost Ballet Russe repertory.
He was a marketing genius, actually. I think that Diaghilev found something that would work as a guest abroad. They loved these mad, passionate Russian steps and these warriors stealing maidens and all of these things that excited them, and also the vivid color of the design. So Diaghilev saw that this Eastern European exoticism was something that the West had a taste for.
Paris wasn't just exciting to Diaghilev, it was really exciting to his dancers, because to them, Paris was the center of fashion, of cuisine, of elegance. On the second season, when the company arrived here at the Gare du Nord, one of the youngest dancers, Lydia Lopukhova, was so excited that she actually fainted. She said, oh, it's the sight of the station, it's so beautiful. It was so exciting that she'd fainted clean away. So while Diaghilev was here to sell his product, the dancers were here to go shopping.
Initially, Diaghilev had built his publicity for the first ballet season around Nijinsky and Anna Pavlova. Pavlova did not actually reach Paris until well into the season, so that there was far more attention paid to Nijinsky. And certainly in the reviews, they're just glowing. The enthusiasm is absolutely palpable. I mean, they called him the god of the dance. And this was something that Diaghilev certainly built upon. But subsequently, Nijinsky really became the most important dancer in the company.
Nijinsky was a dazzling stage performer, and he had this eerie genius for transforming himself within each role. But what audiences most clamoured to see was his extraordinary jump. It was so high that some people thought he must have been suspended from wires. Here's Marie Rombert, one of the Ballet Russe dancers, speaking in 1969.
I can say definitely that I have never seen anybody like him or anybody who made that tremendous impression that he made. Often people say, did he really jump so high? And I always say, I don't know how far from the ground, but I know it was near the stars.
Dancer Freddie Franklin is one of the very few people alive who actually saw the Ballet Russe perform. He's now a sprightly 95 years old, and incredibly, he's still performing on stage. Back in 1929, he also saw Anna Pavlova dance in Liverpool.
I'm sitting way up in the gods. This apparition flew on, and we went. And she had beautiful instep feet when she ran and she sat. But it was the dying swan that, oh, that was incredible. The curtain went up and there was a blue light, there was nothing on, and it was sort of looking, and suddenly there's there, and her back to the audience, and she turned and she did this wonderful solo, and at the very end, there was dead silence for a minute, nothing, and then it went wild. It just went wild.
I'm standing outside the Théâtre Châtelet, which is the theatre where Diaghilev gave his first Paris performances. It's not the city's main ballet theatre, that's the Opera, but it was a big theatre and it was the kind of venue where Diaghilev could pack in the huge, mixed, powerful audience that he needed. I'm on the stage of the Châtelet where the dancers would have performed in 1909 and looking out at these tiers of red plush and gold. What some of the dancers recalled wasn't just the sight of this auditorium, but the smell, the perfume that collectively was given off by this fashionable Parisian audience, some of the dancers found overwhelming. And all that contributed to the fact this wasn't just a great night at the ballet, it was a huge social event. You do get a shiver just standing here, imagining the applause and the excitement and how it must have been for the dancers afterwards, just coming off stage and realising there'd been this enormous hit.
The reviews, I mean, they're ecstatic.
Shall I ever find words to describe such a sight? From the panting, endless lines of motor cars to the dazzle of diamonds reaching as far as the back row of the auditorium.
I never saw anything so beautiful.
Good Lord! I've never seen such a public. Who would have thought their seats were on fire?
You have the feeling that half of Paris was ready to run the aisles and go to the stage, or run the other way and hit the streets. There's just a sense of a kind of kinetic inoculation, if you will, of the audience.
In lots of ways, Diaghilev was a self-invented man. I mean, the Russia he was born into was really still under the stranglehold of the imperial system. Everything was run by the Tsar and the Tsar's offices. And there was something formidable about his willpower and his determination to do something new. He was absolutely like a bulldog in his tenacity. He was determined to get things done, to make things new, and really to do it by the force of his own energy rather than depending entirely on the patronage and the connections and that whole kind of Byzantine system around which the imperial court operated.
Diaghilev was always interested in promoting new scores and commissions.
Stephanie Jordan, professor in dance at Roehampton University.
The starting point that we think about is really the Firebird with Stravinsky. There were harmonies that the French were not used to. There were trickier rhythms that were a novelty as well. There was an exoticism, an oriental sound that was strange to Western Europe at that time. A total shock, I would imagine, after the highly conventional scores that they were used to. Diaghilev found Stravinsky, gave him a job, set him up with a body of work that he could do, established him as a major name, really the most celebrated dance composer of the 20th century. And what would Diaghilev have done without Stravinsky? Well, Stravinsky becomes the backbone of his musical repertoire in many ways, so he's deeply dependent on him, and they share a major artistic sympathy. But they fought. He upset Stravinsky by wanting at one point to make a cut in the Rite of Spring, and another point he wanted to make a cut in Apollo, and that provoked a bitter quarrel. And in fact, there was a moment when the two of them found themselves on the same train, but they didn't speak to each other.
The Paris Opera was